Group Meeting, Sunday, 23rd May, 1982. We all know how much where the discipline of the religious life is concerned. The great teachers have warned us in connection with the senses. In Buddhism particularly, you get the Buddha frequently mentioning, very frequently mentioning, the peril of the senses. And to control and understand the senses and their functioning and our reaction to the senses is something about which very considerable teaching exists in Buddhism, more than in any of the other great scriptures. And I think the Brahmanical Hindu scriptures also follow suit there. We have always been warned against our senses, that they betray us, they seduce us. Up to a point, that is true. And it is true simply because we are ignorant of the nature of the senses and the purpose, the deep purpose which they fulfill in our growth and process of coming to fruition as full-fledged human beings. So there is justification for that. But we must bear in mind that this emphasizes one aspect. There is the other aspect with respect to the senses. What the teachers and what religious teachings, disciplines have warned us against is the indulgence of the senses. They have not spoken much about the right use of the senses. Now, there is a very, very great difference between indulging the senses and using them rightly. The indulgence of the senses indicates our slavery to the pleasure drive. And the pleasure drive, almost without exception, somewhere, somehow, somewhen, is responsible for anxiety, misery, pain, remorse, and sorrow. It is responsible for that. If only because of the memory in one's older years of our past in our young days. Of course, everyone knows that if indulgence where food and drink is concerned is carried to a great excess, unquestionably the body is going to be ill and we are going to suffer for it. We can't get away from that. Everyone knows that. But people feel that, oh, a certain amount of indulgence of this pleasure or that pleasure is perfectly all right. It does happen to be perfectly all right in a sense, namely that the body is such a marvelous thing. The living body is such a marvelous thing that it can deal with the ill effects of any mistaken use of the senses. And we forget what effects there were. But if one carries that sufficiently far, then the result invariably is pain and misery. So it is indulgence of the senses which is the villain of the piece, so to say. On the other hand, we must bear in mind that it is impossible for us to live without using the senses. Of course, we all know how many people live somewhat senselessly, but that is senselessly in the sense of unintelligently. But the senses have to be used all the time. The senses have to be not so much controlled, not so much trained, as allowed to grow freely so that the best possible functioning of the senses can take place. I deliberately say allowed to grow freely, because if we control our sense functioning in the sense of repressing the sense functioning, then there is always illness attending that. It's not repression. It is that sort of quiet understanding of the body and the psyche and the sense functions, which allows the senses to grow happily. This is the important thing. The growth of the senses is somewhat like the growth of a little infant. If that infant is treated in the right way, with understanding, with love, with patience, sympathy, helpfulness, and so on, then that child will grow happily. And this happy growth is what makes for the emergence of a good citizen, a good adult in the world. It's one of the most powerful influences, as we all know. Now, it's the same with the senses. We have to let the senses grow and come to their full and functioning freely and happily. This is a proper living process. The other, it is a living process, it's an integrating activity. The other is a repressive and a mechanical activity. Now, up to a certain point, it is necessary to train the senses in the sort of mechanical way. This is particularly so in the field of scientific work and study. In a laboratory, for instance, if every student was allowed to use his eyesight freely all the time, there would be no progress in science. He has to be trained to look for this, that, and the other phenomenon in the process of his experiment. You see, something which has been discovered through decades and centuries of research and the development of that science. So, the newcomer of today has the advantage of all that heritage behind him. And he can use that heritage in order to avoid the necessity and the burden, and more or less a useless burden, of rediscovering all that has already been discovered as fact, as true. So he's trained to look for this, that, or the other. You see? Now there, of course, he does not use his sense of sight freely. But if he is a good student, he will be able also to use his sense of sight freely to look for that which has not been seen before. Now, to look for that which has not been seen before by past researchers means that the student has to be completely open-minded. He must not have a closed mind. Oh, the professor has said so-and-so, 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 and that's the whole fact, and there is nothing more to it. It's never like that. There is always something new to it. Because amongst all other factors at play there, the individual student is a unique individual, and he brings to bear on his experiment and his observation his own uniqueness. If he merely stuck to what he was instructed to look for, then that uniqueness will not play its part, and he will probably not discover anything new. Therefore, science as such will not grow, will not advance a step further because of that conditioning. So, you see, both aspects play their part, even in terms of scientific work as such. But where life is concerned, and where religious living and yoga are concerned, we have to learn to use our senses, allow our senses to function freely and to be properly observant, which means, of course, that we have to be careful not to let our preconceptions, our assumptions, our biases and prejudices impinge upon what we are observing. How will we know about this impingement? We will find that when we examine something or are observing something, the brain is all the time talking back at what we are observing. It is this talking back that one has to beware of. When the talking back takes place in the process of our observation, examine, immediately turn attention to what the brain is, how the brain is talking back. What is it saying? Because what it says is indicative of our own advanced state or our retarded state, all our conditioning, all our preconceptions, assumptions, all the blockages in our psyche which are at play will come out. So it is necessary to look very, very carefully at what... To listen very carefully to what the brain is chattering away. Now, this is not an easy task, because there is always this peculiar peculiar preconception in us that, oh yes, we know all about it, that we are all right. This self-esteem, this egoism and vanity, which bedevils us all along the line, you see, is at work, and it prevents us from discovering from our observation of the brain's chatter just what there is in our own psyche which hinders our progress. So in any sense of sense functioning, whether it be seeing or hearing, touching or tasting or smelling, or just the ordinary discursive process of thought and feeling, the activity of our imagination, observe all that very, very carefully. And in the observation, we will find that our sense becomes more and more refined, it becomes more and more penetrative, perceptive, acute, and it is necessary for the release of true intelligence from within ourselves that all these things should happen with regard to our sense functioning. The senses must not be deprecated, nor must their importance be depreciated. They are of immense value and immense importance. We will touch upon that a little later on. There will come the time when the senses spontaneously and naturally will function freely and be unobstructive avenues for true perception and for knowledge which is really worthwhile acquiring. The senses are indispensable instruments for all this. You know, one of the great quarrels between Plato and Aristotle was just this, that Aristotle, contrary to what Plato said, declared that there is nothing given in the intellect which is not given through the senses first. Now, that is true only at a very unadvanced level of development in the individual concerned. If an individual is born with natural gifts, so to say, there will be in his intellectual nature things given which did not come through the senses but which were there. We have sometimes called these things intuitive perceptions, deep insights, and so forth. They are naturally there, so that I, for one, rather agree with what Plato presented than what Aristotle presented. But Aristotle is more or less right to a considerable extent, insofar as what he said does apply to the mass of people in the world. It's the few only who are sort of so gifted that that pure mind is able to function through their psyche, through their brains, directly without the mediation of sense perception. Now, particularly with the great religious teachers, they were perhaps, probably, born with that gift. This extraordinary power of direct perception into the reality, into truth. And they did not need sense perceptions in order to arrive at that truth. Their sense perceptions were so pure and perfect naturally in themselves that they confirmed what came directly from pure mind itself within the individual. But they always made it a point to cultivate the senses so that the senses became less and less obstructive to the functioning of true buddhi, what Plato called nous, what we call the noetic faculty within man. So now, let's come back to this. When the senses are functioning, there is always a relationship between oneself and that which is conveyed to oneself through the senses. That is to say, the subject and the object. The subject who is using his senses and the object which is perceived by the senses. There is a relationship between them. Now, that relationship, in the case of most of us in the world, people like ourselves included, is an imperfect relationship. Because we are conditioned beings, we have our mental blocks, our mental defects, where the moral aspect of life is concerned, our mental defilements. Now, these always obstruct, and all too often we are unaware of these blocks and defects and defilements. We are unaware of them. So it becomes necessary, for in order to make that relationship between oneself, the subject, and that which is perceived, which is the object, it is necessary, in order to make that relationship a right relationship, a real living, strong, perfect relationship, to be extremely attentive. This is where the ordinary systems of meditation, which tend to develop the power of concentration, have their value. Where they fail is that concentration tends to be exclusive, not inclusive, of all that comes to us through our senses. To put it in other words, to put it in another form, what we have to do is to become more and more awake. It is this awakening from within. This awakening from within is an intensification of the functioning of our own consciousness as such. That is what happens. When that consciousness really sort of comes, springs into action fully, then we are fully awake. And if we have disciplined ourselves so that nothing in the psyche or in the conditioned brain acts as an obstruction to this, we see truth, we see reality. Whatever situation we are in, whatever comes to us, we can see the truth of it clearly and fully. One becomes clear-sighted. One realizes inward equanimity. One is completely poised at the same time, you see? And one's mindfulness is functioning at its peak. If one's mindfulness is functioning at its peak, then one is in the state of communion with one's surroundings and within oneself all the time. You see, people who tread the religious path seek religious experiences. They might like to go for a trip into the profound realms of consciousness. The idiots take drugs. The wise people discipline themselves, you see. But that is not the real thing. The real thing is to be in this state of communion all the time. This state of communion means that the division between what we call the self and the not self no longer exists. There is only the one total reality existing in terms of the perfect relationship between all the multitudinous parts which constitute that one total reality. This is the holy state. It's the whole state, the healthy state, the complete state. And that is what lies in front of the human species as such. That is what the human species is moving very, very slowly, of course, but step by step towards as its final consummation. That each individual human being will be completely in harmony with the totality, so that there'll be no obstruction coming from him in terms of an isolative or a separative consciousness which creates division in that totality. And the creating and the raising up of division is the real meaning of the word sin. That which tends to disturb or harm or break the unity of the universe. There are very few people who realize that. Who, when I say realize, I don't mean in the full sense of realizing. That is, make real, make it an actual fact in one's life. But who even begin to see that intellectually. Even as a thought. They just don't know this. And that is one of the reasons, that is one of the deep elements which constitutes the ignorance from which human beings suffer. Because they are unaware of it, their lives are a perpetual conflict, a perpetual confusion and a struggle all the time. Trying to assert this separate self over and above and trying to dominate the so-called not-self. It satisfies one's ego. Oh, I did it. I made it. You see, it's like that. And see what happens afterwards. After I've made it, I've got to keep making it, otherwise somebody else becomes the champion. And then there is misery inside oneself. To say nothing of the misery which one has caused everything around us in the process of making it, as we call it. This wasn't it in Shakespeare's Henry VIII, Wolsey, who says, "Cromwell, I charge thee, fling away ambition. By that sin fell the angels." And this ambition springs ultimately, I mean, its deepest root is our isolative self-consciousness, our separative self-consciousness. I am I am not you or anybody else. Only in a certain sense that is true. As far as the mortal, perishable, finite, psychophysical organism is concerned, that organism is unique and not another organism. But what the person never sees is that all organisms are interrelated. They are interrelated, they are interactive. One of the great purposes of yoga, you know how Patanjali he starts off by saying, "Now, Atha Yogash Anusasanam," now an exposition of yoga. And the very next statement is, "Yogas Chitta Vritti Nirodha." Yoga is the overcoming, the fading away, if you like. Fading away for Nirodha is better than overcoming, because that implies conflict. Overcoming implies conflict. It's the fading away of chitta vritti, of the fluctuations of attentiveness, of consciousness. Yogas chitta vritti nirodha. You see? So one sees at once that even in that very first sentence, all that I've tried to suggest here is implied. And religious discipline and yoga both require us to discipline the senses, to let the senses learn. To discipline means to teach. Discipulus, a disciple, a learner. And so the element of teaching comes in. But how does one teach? By compelling somebody else? By forcing certain ideas and ways of life and techniques? Not at all. That is not the perfect way of teaching. Yes, imparting, giving freely information and the skills, the know-how, and so forth, that is involved in it. But in that process, there has always to be this complete and perfect relationship, a relationship of harmony, of understanding that every other person is only another version of myself. Every other person meaning every other psychophysical organism. The organisms are separate, but mankind is one. The tree of mankind is just one tree in which every one of us is a cell or a group of cells, a leaf or a branch, or a flower, or whatever it is. All the beautiful ones are flowers on the tree of life, on the tree of human life, and so forth. We have to move towards that and realize that. And it's a difficult business, because we have to go through what is really the true asceticism. What is the true asceticism? Asceticism comes from the Greek word ascesis, which means a sloughing away of what is unnecessary. Let go what is unnecessary. Look at the work of a sculptor. He takes a block and he starts chipping it, doesn't he? Or whatever he does. I'm not a sculptor, so I don't know. Anybody a sculptor here? You see, bit by bit it's chipped away and the perfect statue or whatever it is emerges. It is there, it is hidden. Similarly, in each of us, the hidden divine potential has to come to full flower. And it is a divine potential because it is essentially that ultimate supreme creative energy which produces the entire universe. That is what it is ultimately. But we have to realize it. How do human beings spoil the understanding of that fact? They think of releasing power out of themselves in order to dominate, to rule, to compel. That is a destructive process. Creative energy creates, that means releases into perfect manifestation. One does not overcome, fight against and overcome evil, but allows it through one's, through the right influence from one to be transformed into eternal beauty through love and understanding. There is no other way. That is the only way. And then there is real fruition, there is peace, there is true happiness. Now, in all this process, the senses play a very important part, because the senses are our avenue, our avenues of our connecting links. The senses are the connecting links by which each one of us gets related to those around us, to the whole of society, to the whole of this world. Not only human beings, but all creatures, plants, the earth itself, the solar system, everything, anything. You see, the senses are the connecting avenues. They are, as I have said time and again, they are the cords of communion with transcendence. When I say they are the cords of communion with transcendence, don't think of it in terms of I, the person, am extending certain cords with transcendence, with the divine or something like that. It is not that. But all absence of relationship, all absence of relationship with the totality, with transcendence, is now gone out of the picture. The connecting cords are part of the whole. Look into your own body and how the body functions and works. Look at the system of nerves, of blood vessels, and all the communicating links inside the body. Now you see, the senses will function like that. And they'll be so healthy, so perfect, that there'll be no obstruction. So there'll be no tumors, no mental breakdowns or nervous breakdowns, as we used to call them, and so forth. We shall truly realize that we are part and parcel of this universe. And it will be a real thing in our consciousness. Now we must bear this in mind carefully. It is one thing to listen or read or be told and then to say, yes, I believe that. That sounds quite right. Yes, I accept that. But that is just a string of words inside the brain. And that string of words inside the brain has no creative potency in itself. Do remember that. If one understands that string of words and works with it, towards it, then what happens is that you become conscious of the reality, the creative power which that string of words stands for. And you see, this is the way in which consciousness comes to its uttermost fulfillment and fruition. I think the Upanishads put these things in the most perfect way that any scripture has put them. There is nothing to touch the Upanishads on this score. They really are the goods. And yoga, of course, as you know, derives from the Upanishads ultimately. When you are truly conscious, then you really know, which means you know not merely with the brain as a set of ideas or a system of thought or philosophy or anything like that, but your whole life of thought and feeling, of speech and action, your relationships, your activities, your interests, everything fully and sweetly expresses that consciousness. Whatever finds expression through the psychophysical organism in our lifetime is the expression of our consciousness. I know that Krishnamurti uses the word consciousness in quite a different sense. He uses consciousness as the content of the psyche, and the emptying of that content of the psyche in the sense of emptying all the conditioning factors and so forth is the freeing of the spirit and the fulfillment of man and so forth. Well, he uses it in that sense. I have always used it in the sense in which I'm talking about it. Of course, this is admittedly due to my heritage, which I happen to have read and studied and worked upon in terms of the Upanishadic and the Buddhistic teachings, you see. So naturally I talk in these terms. But when one is conscious in that way, what has happened is that the creative energy, which is the root source of the entire manifested universe, has become a fully knowing creative energy inside yourself. And that knowingness has no relationship with what we mean by knowingness. A string of words which represent our thoughts and our ideas and our concepts inside the brain only. When one is conscious in that sense, pure mind as such, and as we have often talked in our meetings, pure mind is that archetypal expression of the primordial creative energy which releases a cosmos out of chaos. You see? So that energy knows itself in terms of pure absolute consciousness. Pure mind is quite beyond all conceptualizing and verbalizing. All conceptualizing and verbalizing is subsumed in the activity of pure mind. And it is because of this subsumption of conceptualizing and verbalizing that pure mind, in the person who has realized the enlightened state, can use concepts and words in order to communicate, to inspire with prophetic speech that which he has realized and which can help humanity forward. So now we see what a tremendously important part the senses play in all this, because without the connecting links, we cannot be in touch, so to say, with the totality. And this being in touch is of such paramount importance. Of course, there is an implication here. The being in touch means that one has to beware of retreating from life, of retreating from the world. I don't mean to say, therefore, that a monastic life has no place whatsoever. It has its place, but it is not the whole thing. The monastic life comes prominently into being after the advent of the Buddha. And the monastic life has been very prominent in Christendom, as far as the spiritual life is concerned. Very prominent in Christendom. But the monastic life, for all those who enter a monastery, is a life which tends to be separated from the life of the whole of humanity and of the world in general. The founders, the great founders, two of the greatest spiritual teachers the world has ever had, the Buddha and Jesus, how did they live? They came into the world all the time, all their life. They went into retreat as and when necessary. You and I all go to sleep as and when necessary, don't we? And we sometimes go to sleep when one ought to be awake and listening, but there we are. You see? But they went into the world as much as they possibly could. If you study the life of the Buddha very carefully, you will be amazed to discover how much he moved all the time. He was on the move all the time. I once worked out with a map the sort of route which is... You know, this book, the Vedantic Buddhism of the Buddha by J.G. Jennings, gives a detailed account of all the journeys year after year. And do you know, those days, of course, there were no jet planes or cars or anything like that. He walked. How far did he walk each year? And I worked it out at a minimum 1,500 miles. A marathon walk. He walked every year like that, 1,500 miles. And in the last year of his life, in his 80th year, he made that last tremendous journey, going to the different villages and towns and so forth, and ministering unto the people. And this was the man who first took the monastic step of going out at the age of 29, and until he became enlightened, as it is said, at the age of 35. And then what did he do? Immediately, he didn't stay away from mankind. He straightaway sought mankind. The account given, as you know, is that at first he thought, my goodness, how can I teach these dunderheads this sort of profound truth? I mean, I'm putting it in somewhat classical English by saying, how can I teach these dunderheads? You see, but that was the fact of the matter. He saw what human beings were like, and that they would never, never take to this sort of thing, you see. And then the legendary account goes, Brahma Sahampati, Brahma the Lord of all creatures, you see. Pati means Lord, Master, Husband. Those are the meanings of Pati, aren't they? Brahma Sahampati appears and pleads for mankind. And finally, the enlightened one consents to go out and teach. But what does Brahma Sahampati stand for? There is no sort of supernatural, invisible invisible being in some upper atmosphere who comes floating down to you. Nothing of the sort. Brahmasahampati stands for that within yourself which is the supreme ruler and director of your whole psychophysical life. That is Brahmasahampati. And that element in us, in our nature, that psychical element in our nature which comes up and says, come on boys, at it. This won't do. You must go out and work. And the work which the enlightened one can do is only one work. Spread enlightenment around. If you are gifted with great scientific abilities, or if you are gifted as a first-class photographer or whatever it is, your business is to do that, isn't it? Justify your existence, justify your gifts as a scientist or a photographer or as an explorer or whatever it is, and do that. And go out amongst human beings. So there must be no retreat from life in this process. It is always in the midst of whatsoever is present here and now and around us and comes to us. That is what we have to, that is our field of work, and that is what we have to do. And that is perhaps one of the meanings of living the sensible life. Now, I'm using the word sensible in the sense, in the meaning of an intelligent life, not a stupid activity, you see. To live a sensible life that way. And who can live a sensible life unless his senses are functioning freely, rightly, fully, and happily? Do remember that, happily. Because when, and happiness, you will never escape happiness. You can't run away from it. You can't try to avoid it. If you live rightly, meaning that you as the particular psychophysical organism are fulfilling your particular destiny, it is impossible for you to be unhappy. Troubles, difficulties will come. Pains, pleasures will all come and go, one after the other. Now you'll say that I'm talking contradictorily. No. They will come. But what is the meaning of happiness? What is the meaning of inner stability and all that? It is a mental thing. It's the mind that suffers, the psyche that suffers, it is the psyche that enjoys. But if the psyche is pure, it is able to take in everything that happens. And take it in like a man, even if you are a woman.